Now I'm recording.
I guess that beginning part of the lecture won't be in the class recording this week. So telling the story, you know, I always emphasize to the guys, tell the story, draw the picture. It can be a line drawing, it can be a little doodle. I am not an artist, that was my father. If you Google my family last name, you get him before me, which doesn't bug me at all. But then what you do is you decompose vectors into components. So let's take this approach and take a look at an example statics problem. And this is a fairly typical of what you might encounter in your homework. And I'm about to, I'm copying that picture. And then I'm going to switch to my whiteboard. So I have three lines with three tensions. And there's a T2, a T1, and a T3. And then there's an object of a certain weight W. So using my vast artistic skills, I just copied that particular picture and drew it down. Okay? You should, by now, or soon after you do the homework, look at the problem like this and immediately think, oh, statics. I need to follow my recipe, which is draw my coordinate system, draw my forces, and identify where those forces meet, what objects those forces act on. There are a couple of different options here. There are really, it may look completely obvious, but depending on what's being asked, it's not necessarily obvious, right? I can look here, of course, where those tensions T1, T2, and T3 all meet. And if that weight is hanging there and nothing is moving, nothing is accelerating, this is kind of the classic standard statics problem. But I could just as well look here. I could just look at the object, the weight itself. I could look anywhere along any one of these lines. It's a trivial problem because there are two tensions acting on that piece of rope or that piece of cable, acting in opposite directions, but they're equal and opposite, just like Newton's third law. But understand that there is nothing special about statics and Newton's third law that applies to only one point or another. Okay, it's only where those forces interconnect, only where those forces all act together, however, where the real interesting things occur. So let's take that point, and now what we want to do is we want to draw a force diagram. This is part of the recipe, right? Select an important point, a relevant point, a relevant object, and draw the force diagram. I can also draw the force diagram for this particular object. And there's a tension T3 pointing up, which is the same as that tension T3 pointing down over there, right? So again, this picture here is somewhat obvious, but I can still write down the net forces in the y direction acting on the object are T3 minus W, because W is pointing in the negative direction, and that object ain't moving, so the acceleration is zero. And that tells you something that you kind of would say is obvious, but physics makes the, physics works for the obvious stuff just as well as it works for the harder stuff, right? So we know that the tension on that line going down is the weight of the object. If there were other forces involved here, this could get more complicated, and that tension might not be the weight of the object. If all of this stuff is in an elevator and accelerating, that T3 is not the weight of the object anymore. It has to include the acceleration of the object, because the object would be accelerating over here, and I'd have a W plus MA, right? So just because it feels completely trivial for one case does not mean you shouldn't think about it. So I've got this tension T3 there, I've got this tension T1, this tension T2 here. And now what I do is I decompose my vectors, right? This angle is also that theta. Whenever you draw the force diagram, make a habit of decomposing your vectors. That's T1 cosine theta, and there's a T1 sine theta. You practice that enough, you don't even have to really go through Sokotoa. I still do it in my head, believe it or not, just because I always want to get it right. So I drew the picture, I identified this as a statics problem, I draw the force diagram, and now, and only now, I should write down Newton's second laws in each dimension. Because Newton's second law, right, F net, is a vector equation. And a vector equation is just a really shorthanded way of writing down three scalar equations, an x, y, and z. And here the z doesn't matter, so I'm only writing down two equations. So I'll write it down in the x direction, f net x. In the x direction, what forces do I have? I have a positive t1 cosine theta. I have a negative t2. Is my object accelerating in the horizontal direction? No, in this problem it's not. In the y direction, I have the net y forces, our t1 times the sine of theta, and I have t3 pointing down. Right, and I know from the Newton's second law for the object hanging from the cable, that's t1. Sine theta minus the weight of the object, W, is equal to 0. Okay? That T3 is equal to W. The tension is equal to the weight. And remember, if this was all in an elevator, that just wouldn't be the weight. It would also include the mass times the acceleration, right? So far, so good. Now what I've got is I've got what, classically at least, yeah, sure, what's up?
That weight is gravity. That weight is the mass times mg. Right. And it's just shorthanded in a problem like this. They just say W. Because writing out mg all the time is two symbols, gravity and W. It's fine, it's a force. I mean, the other advantage of writing down W is it emphasizes gravity is a force, Todd, right? And if you write down mg, you're biased to think, oh, acceleration of gravity, blah, 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 I should put it on the acceleration side. No, but gravity, weight of an object on the force side. Okay?
So I've got, at this point, okay, we are done with physics. The rest of this problem is all just algebra or math, right? The physics was Newton's laws and the vector decomposition to build in the Newton's second law. But once I've got these, now what I need to do is I need to manipulate two equations and two unknowns, or if there were another object hanging from another cable, I would have another set of equations with another set of unknowns. I might have three equations with three unknowns, four equations with four unknowns. You will be taught at some point more advanced ways to solve big complicated sets of equations like that efficiently. But for now, in this class, almost everything you will see is two equations, two unknowns, or three equations, three unknowns. And the standard way that you solve this is you take one of the equations. Generally what I do is I write down next to each one What are my unknowns? What are the things I don't know? Well, here I just don't know T1. I know the object's weight, but I don't know the tension. Okay. And here I don't know T1 or T2. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the one equation with one unknown that I know and solve it for T1. So T1 is equal to the weight of the object divided by the sine of this angle theta. And I can plug in numbers if I have them and figure out T1. And I'm going to take it and substitute it into the other one. Now I know T1 and I can solve this other one for T2. Right, which is, if I plug in this T1, T2 is equal to the weight of the object times the cosine of theta over the sine of theta. Which is what? The cotangent, I think, right? The weight times the cotangent of theta. And then I can plug in numbers and plug and chug into my calculator and all that stuff. But the recipe should be the thing that you concentrate on. Draw the picture, draw the force diagrams, write Newton's laws. If you get this far in a test, you're getting 80% of the 80% of the credit for the problem. If you make a math error, we might dock you a little bit, but probably not that much. Okay? And then out of that I see thing, there was that one last item. I just executed the solution, and I just wrote down Newton's laws after the setup, and I solved multiple equations with multiple unknowns. And now I want to evaluate the answer. Now I want to think. Just having the answer isn't good enough, because Lord knows I'm a physicist, right? So the other thing that strikes me as a little unusual about this is, well, I know the sine of theta goes to zero if theta goes to zero, right? So what happens if theta goes to zero? Well, if theta goes to zero, what I have is I have the object kind of hanging off some line here. And so this is the theta equals zero case, where the object is trying to hang from two wires flat against the ceiling. What does this tell me? It tells me that I can't do this. It tells me that that tension on that line there, if I try and hang this thing from two cables on the ceiling, they're always going to sag a little bit. If I try and make that angle zero, I have to make the tension in that cable infinite. Which naively makes sense, is consistent with what you expect, but it's nice to see the math bear it out. It also tells me that if that theta goes to 90 degrees and this object is over here and then the weight is hanging here, if theta goes to 90 degrees, the tension in the first line becomes the weight of the object. And the tension in the second line at 90 degrees becomes zero. It's just the line hanging there, not really tugging or pulling on the other cable that the weight is hanging from. So those next steps of looking at the solution and saying, okay, what happens if I change some of the variables? That next level of insight is what makes you from a competent physics student to a good physics student. So, but the recipe, technique, should be kind of straightforward, right? So this technique, let's put it on a different board here. Any statics problem you end up with, you can apply that technique to. Let's take a look at, I worked out over there, you know, earlier this morning, one of the homework problems, and now I'm going to draw the guy the wrong way. So there's a guy pulling on some boxes up an inclined plane. And Lord knows by now, identify, right? You should look at this problem and go, oh, force of gravity down, maybe a force of friction, force of somebody pulling on this thing. I bet this is a statics problem, right? And statics being, I'm going to put quotes around statics, because something moving at constant velocity is still, in physics speak, a statics problem. In this particular homework problem, these boxes are moving up the plane of the constant velocity. They're moving down the plane? Oh, okay, well, I can do it whichever way you like. I'm kind of making it up as we go. They're moving down the plane of the constant velocity. Constant velocity still implies that the acceleration is zero. So let's draw some axes. Yes, like I've said before, physics doesn't care about your axes. I could draw the axes like this, as long as they're perpendicular, and do all the math of the problem, but boy, it would be painful. But I'd still get the right answer if I do follow the recipe. So the recipe, you know, the recipe here, one, is to identify, you know, is identify the statics problem. I'm going to follow the statics recipe. I'm going to set it up. So now setting it up, it's a question of asking, okay, what can I find out? So let's say I'm given the velocity. In your homework, you're actually given the kinetic and static coefficients of friction. And you can see that here, if this box is sliding, that's kinetic coefficient of friction, and if this box is staying still, it's the static coefficient of friction. The boxes aren't sliding with respect to each other. The same recipe will do this problem as complicated as you get. If those boxes are sliding against each other, recipe still works. If the boxes aren't moving and the guy's just pulling, recipe still works. Might not have all the information you need to solve the problem, but the recipe works, okay? So you're given the velocity, you're given these coefficients of friction, and you're given the masses of the objects. And you're given, let's say, the angle of the inclined plane. It's like, you know, these are all things that you might measure if you're actually running the movie and telling the story and doing this experiment, right? Let's stack these boxes on this inclined plane with these coefficient of friction and see how much it takes to pull these things. And then compare that to what I figure out. Okay? So now, what I'm going to do in the setup is I have to draw some pictures. I have to draw force diagrams. I can draw a force diagram now. If I'm trying to figure out the tension of this thing, close my eyes, right? And I'm sliding these boxes down this plane, but I don't know that it's two boxes stacked on top of each other. I just know, boy, this thing is heavy that I'm keeping sliding down the plane at a constant velocity. So I've got my total thing, M1 plus M2, sliding down. I got the force of gravity. And boy, the force of gravity doesn't point in either my x or y direction, so I better decompose that vector. This is the angle theta. I'm pulling on the thing. And you've been taught that there is a force acting perpendicular to the plane, a normal force, that keeps those things from falling into the plane, right? So these are, there is one more force that is acting on these sets of boxes. Because I said, gosh, there's friction involved as well. And remember, the force of friction always acts opposite to the velocity when something is sliding, and it's a coefficient of kinetic friction. So there's a force of friction which is equal to the coefficient of kinetic friction times that normal force. Okay? So this is part of the setup, drawing this force diagram. Get lots of points from just doing this. Because now all you need to do is to evaluate and evaluate Newton's second law. Right? The net forces in the y direction, well, there's the normal force pointing up, pointing down in the y direction is this component of gravity, Fg cosine theta. And by gosh, the box is not accelerating up or down. And then the horizontal forces, if down is positive, that means that this force of gravity is positive, this component, sine theta. But these two other forces, the tension and the friction force, are negative. They're pointing up the plane. Physics done. Solve two equations, two unknowns, right? What are the unknowns here? The unknowns, well, in this case, the only unknown is m for the y direction. And in the x direction, the unknowns are n and t. I said I was given the coefficient of kinetic friction and the wave of the object and the angle and all that stuff. So that's fine. So the normal force is equal to force of gravity times the cosine of theta. I can plug that into the next second equation, and I get the force of gravity times the sine of theta minus the tension minus that coefficient of kinetic friction times that normal force, Fg sine theta, is equal to zero. Cosine theta, sorry, thank you. But then I can get the tension in the line. Does this make sense? It makes sense in the sense that if there's no friction, the force I need to apply to keep this thing from accelerating is counteracting the gravitational force down the plane, which is fine. Right? And friction helps me keep those things from sliding. So friction reduces the force that I need to apply, which makes sense. And then you can play with the angle, right? What happens when the angle is 0 degrees or 90 degrees or 45 degrees, whatever it is. Same exact recipe. And that is also kind of, you know, thinking about the problem after the fact. Then what you can do is you can now, I took a look at this by looking at both of the boxes together, but I can also look at the boxes individually and figure out the forces between them, because I know the coefficient of static friction between them as well. So I can figure out the forces between the boxes. I can figure out kind of everything else kinetically, statically about the problem. If this box were accelerating, And there was another example in some of the advanced problems where the box is accelerating down the plane rather than just sliding at constant velocity. I just use Newton's second law and add the acceleration in, F equals ma, right? And solve the problem that same way. Same recipe. So this is, ultimately, at the end of the day, the recipe to do all of the statics homework, and in fact, a bunch of your regular static stuff. You gotta be able to decompose the vectors. You gotta be able to draw your axes, draw your vectors of all your forces, and categorize them. If you can't get there, talk to me and we'll work on your technique to get there. But after that, that's getting you over the hump. After that, it's all a downhill or a down plane slide. Are there any other questions about statics before we move on? Because we got to move on to energy stuff, which is a different recipe. But a recipe that's, in my mind, kind of a little bit more fun because you don't need to worry about vectors so much. So let's put this aside. And talk about energy and work. And I talked about some of this last Wednesday. And these problems are a little bit harder to identify, right? Oftentimes that identify problem, looking at the problem and saying, oh my God, where do I start? I got this thing moving here, I've got a guy jumping out of an airplane or a bomber flying over this and dropping a bomb and moving down an inclined plane and there's friction and there's gravity and da-da-da-da-da. All of a sudden it looks like you know way too much and you don't know where to start. Okay? Energy problems, honestly, energy and when we get to conservation of momentum, the same thing. You'll find that you actually almost every problem you look at, you try and start solving this way first because it's relatively straightforward and the recipe is very straightforward. And it doesn't involve all of the vector stuff that the statics does, which is a godsend to those that have difficulty with vectors. Okay? So, but oftentimes there are objects moving at a certain velocity at some point in the problem, but that velocity is usually changing. An object moving with a certain velocity has energy, right? I mean, it's kind of kinetic energy, the energy of motion. And then I can take that energy and store it places. I can store it in batteries. I can store it in gravitational potential energy. I can store it in springs. We come up with this little shopping list. And yes, you will be given that little shopping list in the midterm because it's trivial to look these things up. But there is a shopping list of different places that you can put energy at various times in a particular problem. Let's go through the recipe first, okay? So I always call energy conservation problems accounting 101 because for a week or so I turn you guys into accountants. All it is keeping a little table and drawing a little table and filling in the energies of the system at various times in various places and adding them all up and making sure that both columns end up to be equal at the end. That's it. That is fundamentally, at the end of the day, the technique for solving energy and momentum conservation laws. Okay? And again, it'll involve multiple equations and multiple unknowns quite commonly. So where do these terms come from, right? Last class I was, you know, dropping chairs over here and waking you up all out of your complacency. If I move something against gravity, remember work is force times distance, and work is energy. Man, I did a lot of work today. I exerted a lot of energy. Okay. And signs get a little bit tricky because if I'm doing work, I'm
putting out energy. Energy is negative from me to positive in the things I did. If I lift up against the force of gravity, okay, I'm putting energy into the gravity, the spring between me and the earth, or the object and the earth. That's positive. I let it go, that energy comes back out again, becomes negative.
Signs matter. Just like the vectors, signs matter. So this is probably the most fundamentally challenging part of energy conservation problems, is getting the signs right. And I'll show you how to do that. But gravity, work done against gravity, energy stored in gravitational potential is the weight of the object times the distance, because work is force times distance. If I take a spring, and remember the force of the spring is proportional to how much I stretch the spring, I stretch it twice as far, I need twice as much force to keep it there. Okay, so I actually have to add up all of those little force times distances. I have to integrate the force of the spring over the distance I stretch it, and therefore I end up getting the work I did, the energy I put in, or got out of the spring, as 1/2 kx². This is another one of your accounting terms. And so now you got two of them, accounting term, mgh for potential energy and gravity, accounting term 1/2 kx² for stretching a spring. And then there's kinetic energy, 1/2 mv², the energy of an object that's moving. Okay? So I got a little, I got three of those, kinetic energy, energy from moving something against gravity, energy of stored in a spring. And then also there's one other force that you can kind of incorporate. Not every, all the textbooks do, but I like to, because it is a little bit of a hidden place, right? The force of friction. Friction is a force. That force acts over a distance. You know the equation of the force of friction. So you can figure out the energy lost to pushing something. And that's the force of friction times the distance I pushed it. If I take my, my chair, okay, this one's rolling, but, if I take my chair and I push it around the road, and I come back to where I was, I didn't store any energy of gravity, because the chair didn't change height, didn't put any energy in the spring, because there aren't any springs there. Where did all that energy, where did all that force times distance work go of me pushing around that chair? Into friction, and you can use that in the accounting too. Okay? So there's, so we can revisit some things in this light. And let's revisit the simple thing to teach the technique, and then we'll get successively more complicated. But remember the accounting. Okay, so this is energy. And the accounting for energy is what? Is the potential energy from gravity is mgh or mg delta y. The potential energy in the spring is 1/2 kx². The kinetic energy of an object is 1/2 mv². And then there's also the energy due to friction or something like that, which was the kinetic force of friction times the normal force times whatever distance it was that I moved the thing. Those are the four energy terms that I've given you so far. We're going to go over a couple of different examples that are going to get progressively less trivial. Okay? First example is going to look mighty familiar. Okay, and that's your professor's ball toss again. Right? Now, we did all of this in kinematics before. We figured out, delta y equals v0 yt plus 1/2 at squared and all of that stuff. We can do the same problem just using energy conservation. Now, the key about energy conservation is identifying times, identifying snapshots of time. And let me say, let's take a look at three different particular times when I'm throwing this ball up and down. Just like kinematics, where I have initial and final, now I'm going to label three times. The time when I start the throw, the time when the object is at the top of the throw, and the time when the object hits the ground. And what I'm going to do is now, once I've done that little bit of setup there, once I've kind of organized things, I'm going to start drawing a table. And this is 1, 2, and 3. And these are the kind of energy terms. That I'm going to use. And yes, it's going to look a bit like accounting. So let's take a look at the different energy terms, right? Potential energy due to gravity. Let's say that I start out with y pointing up, and y equals 0 is at the ground. It turns out this will all work no matter where you set y equals 0, as long as you keep y equals 0 consistent through every frame of the movie. If I set y equals 0 at my hand, fine. If I set y equals 0 at the top, if I set y equals 0 on the moon, okay. It's going to be a lot harder to measure, but it'll work. Because what matters is the changes in height from kind of where I was. So let's write down the potential energy due to gravity. At location 1, I've got my ball, mg, and that height is kind of like y1. Okay? At location 2, my energy is mgy2, and at 3, my energy is 0, because that's why I chose my y equals 0 location. Is there any potential energy due to a spring? No, there's no potential energy due to a spring, so there aren't any springs bouncing around in this problem. If there were, I could put them in, but there aren't. This is an easy problem so far. And then there's kinetic energy. And the kinetic energy of the ball moving is mg v1 squared, 1/2 mv1 squared. 1/2 mv2 squared. 1/2 mv3 squared. Okay. And there's no friction, blah, blah, blah. That's fine. The three-column accounting, okay, let's add these all together. So the sum of all of the energies in 1 is mg y1 plus 1/2 mv squared 1. In 2, it's mg y2 plus 1/2 mv2 squared. And then 3, it's just the kinetic energy of the thing falling. And what I'm doing is I'm setting each one of these equal to each other. that statement is a physics statement, and it's saying that you take the accounting and you conserve the energy. So all of the energy at time one is equal to all of the energy at time two is equal to all of the energy at time three. Okay, so at time two, what's my velocity? It's actually zero, right? My vertical velocity at the top was zero. So let's take the two and the three equations. And that's mgy2 is equal to 1 half mv3 squared. The m's cancel out. I get v3. My velocity at the bottom is just the square root of 2 times g times that height that I was at the top, right? This equation should look kind of familiar. You could get it from kinematics, too. But here I didn't do any kinematics. I didn't do acceleration velocity. I didn't incorporate the acceleration of gravity. I used gravity only as a source of energy. But I end up getting an equation, I end up getting a result relating to an object falling a certain distance that's exactly the same as kinematics. And if you work out the kinematics, you get the same result. Okay? So now this is kind of magic, though, because I could take, you know, I could take a time 4 when it returns back to my hand. And the gravitational energy didn't change. The only things that are different between 1 and 4 are the one velocity is up and one velocity is down. The kinetic energy goes like v squared, right? The kinetic energy doesn't care about the sign of the velocity. So in figuring out 1 to 4, this kind of immediately tells me, okay, the velocity going up has to be the same as the velocity going down at that time. Because the potential energy from gravity didn't change, and there's no place else to put that energy. So it has to come back as kinetic energy. See, there's an exchange between this potential energy and kinetic energy. And I've got that in a slide. So I look at the ball, and now what I've done is I've drawn a little picture here of that ball going up and that ball coming down, and plotted out the kinetic and potential energies. And the kinetic energy, if I throw the ball up, is going down at the top of its trajectory. The ball stops, there's no kinetic energy. And then it gains kinetic energy coming back down again as it's losing its gravitational potential energy. But the sum together is always the same. The sum is the total energy of the ball throwing it up and coming back down. And a real physicist doesn't see, you know, ball going up, ball going down velocity. A real physicist sees an exchange between potential and kinetic energy. And the remarkable thing about it is the accounting. Okay, so I've taught you just a few accounting things, right? I've taught you places that you can hide this energy or account for this energy when you do your spreadsheet, when you do your accounting 3 or 4 column thing. And you can imagine that there are other places that you store energy. When we get to rotational motion, there's energy stored in rotation. So I take this remote and I throw it up. And I don't just throw it up as a static object, but it's got some energy in its spin now, too. And so that picture, which was so simple and just kinetic energy being transformed into potential energy being transformed back into kinetic energy, now there's an extra term in there, which is
kinetic energy of that thing spinning around.
Add it into the spreadsheet. Still works. The technique still works as long as you do all of your accounting properly and aren't cheating, right? Because if there is, you know, let's say there was some extra piece in the system that took energy out or put energy in, and you weren't accounting for it, this isn't going to work. You have to account for all of the energy in the system for this to work. Just like thermodynamics and temperature and all of that good stuff. So this is an easy example. This is an example where you could do the kinematics using stuff you already learned in this class and end up with the answer. So it doesn't feel like you gain anything from this. In some sense, you do a little bit. Okay, you still need to indicate positive y is that direction, because the potential energy due to gravity depends on that positive or negative thing. But now I'm going to make it a little bit harder. Okay, and we're going to extend it a little bit and still use the same technique, but do it in a problem where you cannot use your standard kinematics anymore. But it's a problem that I already alluded to a little bit in class. And I should have brought it today, but I didn't, because it's Monday morning and I forgot. So this particular problem, instead of an object being thrown up and down, I've got an object swinging. I've got a pendulum. And it's a pendulum of length L and mass M. And some angle, theta, as it swings around. Now you can look at the pendulum using all of your good statics stuff, right? You can look at your pendulum, you can call this, you know, time one and this time two and this time three, and say, okay, here's a, gosh, you know, at time one, I've got a tension acting on this guy, I've got the force of gravity acting down, I know my acceleration is perpendicular. To the tension at the very top of its swing. But remember the example I showed, you know, up on the board and the little animation I put in the class notes. The direction of the acceleration is changing all the time. The acceleration is this way here. It's this way here. It's this way here. Oh, God. Trying to do the statics approach of just drawing this picture and decomposing and including my acceleration and all of those terms in this is going to be hard. Because now the acceleration is changing all the time. It's not an easy problem. And doing this properly with just kinematics or just statics, just Newton's laws, you can do it, but boy, it sucks. Okay? But now you can do it. You've been taught a different way. And where we don't have to worry about the accelerations anymore, we don't have to worry about the forces anymore. All we have to worry about is incorporating our energies and drawing down our table. Okay? And the only challenge now is that it does involve a little bit of math, because the energy due to gravity, the potential energy due to gravity, is this height, right? So gravity's pointing down, so my axis better point up. So for part one, you know, what is the height? What is delta y? If I call y equals zero at the bottom, figuring out this delta y is a little bit tricky. But it's not nearly as tricky as doing this with all of the statics, f equals ma stuff. So I can draw a triangle here. I can draw this as theta. That side is L. Remember, this thing goes down to the bottom here. So this side here, this is that delta y, right? This side of the triangle here, so ka, right? So this is going to be, this side is L cosine theta. So this delta y is equal to L minus L cosine theta, right? This total distance is L here. I subtract off this part of this triangle, and I get this remainder of the height, which is that delta y, which is that total length L minus this section of the triangle, L cosine theta. That is the hardest part of this problem using energy, by far. Okay, so now we have, you know, delta y1 is equal to L minus L cosine theta. Let's erase that little helper there, figuring that out, and now we can follow the prescription. And let's just look at 1 and 2 for now. I'm going to look at the potential energy due to gravity. At item 1, it's mg delta y 1, that thing. And at the top of the swing, the pendulum isn't moving. Right? The potential energy is zero. Kinetic energy at the top of the swing at one, the pendulum isn't moving. At the bottom of the swing, the pendulum is moving at 1/2 mv squared. And that's mv2 squared, let's say. No friction, no springs, nothing else. So I can set these equal. So mg delta y1 is equal to 1/2 mv2 squared. Okay, the m's cancel. I end up getting the velocity at the bottom is the square root, oddly enough, of 2g delta y1. It's funny that that looks just like me throwing the beanbag. But now I know that y1 is related to some things about the pendulum. 2g l times 1 minus cosine theta. If you were to try and figure this out using standard kinematics, it would be hard. It would be really hard to get that 1 minus cosine theta stuff in there. But using just energy conservation and using nothing more than two-column accounting, disparage accountants all you want, but they sure know energy conservation. Okay? That's all this takes. Now, this is interesting, right? So if I take the original theta equals zero, cosine of theta, cosine of zero is one, this ends up being zero, that V2 ends up being zero, that's just the pendulum sitting there, that makes sense. if theta max goes up to 90 degrees, then I kind of get a maximum velocity here of square root of 2gl, right? And cosine of theta of 90 degrees, cosine of 90 degrees is zero, so that term goes away. So, but doing all of this, so now I can do a little more magic. What's the tension in that line? Now I can combine statics and energy conservation. I've got the tension acting up, I've got the weight of the object pointing down, and this thing is moving in a circle. You know its acceleration. Its acceleration was mv squared over L. It's moving in a little circular arc at the bottom of the swing. So mv2 squared. Okay? So now I can use Newton, right? I can say F net y is equal to MAy, right? This is the vertical component of the acceleration. And that net force is the tension minus the weight acting on the object at the bottom of the swing. And the acceleration, there's no M in that, it's just V squared over R, is V2 squared over L, which is this thing over L, right? Which is 2g, 1 minus cosine theta. And I divided out the L, so the L went away. So the tension in the line is mg plus 2g, 1 minus cosine theta. I can plug in numbers if I want. But that is going the next level. That is using energy conservation and then using Newton to figure out if I take my pendulum and I swing it, what is the maximum tension as I swing that pendulum around in that line. If I've got a wrecking ball and I need to have a spec, an engineering spec on the cable, to keep that wrecking ball from snapping the cable as it swings through the bottom of the swing, use this. And the tension in that line is not just the weight of the object, but you add in, oh, there's got to be an M in there somewhere. I missed an M. M-A-Y, there needs to be an M there. There needs to be an M there. My units didn't work out otherwise. So this is kind of neat, right? It's the mass, it's the weight of the object times 1 plus 2 times 1 minus cosine theta. I can write that out further, right? That's the weight of the object times 1 plus 2 is 3 minus 2 cosine theta. Something doesn't work there. Something's funny there. But in any event, the approach is right. Okay? You couldn't do this, right? This would be really hard just using statics. This would be really hard just doing kinematics. But something as simple as the technique of an accounting table is all you need to do it. So let's take a 6-minute break. Let's take come back at a quarter after, and we'll do a roller coaster. We'll do a loop-de-loop and incorporate some extra friction items on sliding things on inclined planes too for the rest of the class. What was that? The acceleration of an object moving at a constant velocity in the circle. Remember, we did circular motion, and that was V squared over R.
Yeah, right. V squared over R is what it takes to accelerate something in a circular motion. Now this bugs me though. There's got to be a sign somewhere. Acceleration is that way. MV squared over R.
Hey, what's up?
How's it going?
Do you have anything written down anywhere to where you can put on Blackboard?
There's, you can take a snapshot. There's, I'm gonna write them down and put them in the class notes.
So, oh, you're gonna start doing that or something?
Yeah, okay. I'm gonna try and do that. That's a good point, actually. I've seen some people, I think I saw you taking a photo, right? Some people take photos of the. I'm trying to talk through it, right? So, yeah.
So you think you'll start doing that, put them online, the ones you're doing live?
Yeah. But, I mean, these are, and this narrative, hopefully, I'm trying to make sure that the narrative is clean, too, because teaching you guys technique, it's all about making sure you get that the technique, if you follow the same approach every time and don't take shortcuts, it'll help.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
I just had a question about like the grading policy. I was reading the syllabus and stuff. I'm just a little confused because I know you do it on an absolute scale.
So. Yeah, but I mean it's not quite as absolute as that.
Okay.
So there's what I do is after the second midterm. So I already emailed you out kind of your relative ranking within the class for the midterm.
Yeah.
For the first midterm. Mm-hmm. For the second midterm, I actually do a. Along with that, I do a grading cut.
Okay, great. So, currently at?
Yeah, so everybody will get an idea of where they are, not in just the number within the class, but the grading cuts as well.
Okay.
And the grading cuts included in the midterm, I did put along with the solution guide that's out there, there's statistics on everything, including the full distribution of the total statistics.
Okay.
You can almost see the cuts in there, right? So you can almost guess right away, okay, that's A plus is A minus is B is, because people cluster quite naturally.
Okay.
And the other thing is if you ever want me to kind of like rough guess your current grade in the class, email me and I'm happy to try.
I'll probably do that after the second midterm.
After the second midterm, I'll do it for everybody.
Yeah, okay.
That's part
how
of
much
it.
Is like homework, like the extra credit points and stuff? Is that like a significant?
That adds into the homework.
Okay.
Right? So the homework score is prorated against the full score.
Okay.
And then and for all of you guys doing the extra credit homework, is extra credit above that.
Okay.
I take that percentage, and for the advanced students, that's the straight percentage. For you guys, it's the lower percentage, and if you do above that, you get extra credit from there.
Thank you.
Or it covers up for older homework where you have trouble. Hey. Yeah. So remember, an object moving in a circle at constant velocity needs a centripetal acceleration of v squared over r. And that's where I got the acceleration, v squared over r, because the radius is the length.
Okay, gotcha.
Hey,
hi.
What's up?
I wasn't able to make it in last class, so I think
Braxton, that's right. So I put audio of the class online, but
tests.
I have them in my car actually.
Oh, okay. All right,
from the midterm. Did you get the email?
Yeah, I saw the grade online, so it's not a big deal.
Okay, yeah, exactly. I'll bring them in on Wednesday. I completely just
It's Monday morning. I just blew it.
Okay, great. I'm sorry. So, but I'll bring it in then.
All right, thank you.
Sure. So let's see, what type of a problem should I do? Okay. So let's get back into it. I'm keeping boards up here. Anybody that wants to take photos of the boards, you're certainly welcome to. You can take, you know, photos straight off the screens too, but sometimes it's easier to take photos. I'll also try and post the photos along with the class notes later on. So going forward, right, so we just did the pendulum, and the pendulum is a great example, because then you can take it that next step, and you can calculate the actual tension in the line as it's swinging, right, which is would be rather hard to do if you didn't have energy conservation available to you. So another kind of classic example of energy conservation is the roller coaster loop. Roller coaster loop. Okay. And this is, let's say you're designing a roller coaster in your backyard or wherever, and you know that, okay, you need to start your roller coaster on the hill a certain height, or else it's not going to go around the loop. It's going to fall off the loop. And you don't want everybody to fall off the loop and die because lawsuits, blah, blah, blah. You know, it gets very messy. So the question here is, given the parameters of the problem, and I've got this roller coaster of mass M, turns out that it won't matter what the mass of the roller coaster is. I could do this experiment with a marble and some, you know, toy racetrack or something like that too. But the question is, if I start with velocity equals zero, so I start just holding my object at the top of this hill and I let it go, what is H1 is necessary to just make it around. To just barely make it around the loop. Now here you get into a funny little phrasing thing, right? What does it mean to just barely make it around the loop? Well, if I don't make it around the loop, what happens up here is that the kind of the force applied from the track becomes zero, right? I come off of the track. I don't need the track to hold me. If I'm going too fast, of course I'm pressing against the track and the track is exerting a normal force on me. So just barely around the loop effectively is saying that the normal force from the track is zero at the top of the loop. Okay, the track is not helping me curve or hindering me curve. I'm essentially almost in like a little bit of a free fall. And that's what you get when you're going around a good roller coaster loop, right? You get a little bit of air time, a little bit of free fall that's fun. So I'm going to use my energy conservation stuff again. And this is, again, almost as simple as the pendulum, right? Because in one case, it's all gravitational potential energy. In one case, it's kinetic energy. I'm moving around this top of the loop. I'm not at velocity equals zero. So there certainly should be a velocity 4 here. But I still have some gravitational potential energy now. So I'm going to write down my energy terms. Energy terms for case 1 and case 2. And I'm just identifying two different times when I'm looking at things. So there's the potential energy due to gravity. In the case of 1, I'm at mg, and I drew y equals 0. I drew y equals 0 at the bottom of the loop, let's say, because I'm building this roller coaster above the ground. So that is mgh1. In case not 2, let's say this is 4 instead, at the top of the loop. Now I still have some gravitational potential energy. It's mg, and what's my height above ground here if this loop is circular of radius r? 2r, okay? So that's mg times 2r at the top. My kinetic energies are pretty straightforward, right? At the top, I have no kinetic energy. At the top of the loop, I'm going at 1/2 mv4 squared. Okay. So far so good. I can use my accounting to just say mgh1 is equal to mg times 2r plus 1/2 mv4 squared. All of the m's cancel. And now I've got a little bit of a problem. Okay. I've got a nice equation that I got from energy conservation, but I have two unknowns. I've got v4, and I've got h1. And I can't solve one equation for two unknowns. There must be another constraint. There must be another way to write down another equation. And there sure is. Just like the pendulum, I'm moving around in a circle here. Okay, and at the very top of the roller coaster, in that brief instant, my velocity is constant. Okay. In that brief instant here, I'm moving in that direction. And remember, I said that the normal force of the track is equal to zero but there's still my weight acting on me. And I'm going around a circle of radius r at roughly a constant velocity. So my net forces, of which there's only mg, right, the mass times the acceleration, is equal to mg is equal to my mass times my acceleration, and the acceleration going around in a circle is v4 squared, and it's a circle of radius r, right? Just like the pendulum problem. My acceleration, I'm going around very briefly a circle at very close to a constant velocity, so I can use this centripetal acceleration, and this gives me that these two m's cancel, that a is equal to v4 squared over r. So that means that the velocity that I'm going at around the top of the track with is equal to the square root of r times g. And I can use this and plug it in here. And now I've got g times h1 is equal to 2rg plus 1 half times this thing squared, which is rg. All the g's cancel. And I end up getting that h1 is equal to 2r plus a half r, which is 5 halves r. It's kind of amazing that all I get, the only thing that height depends on, is the radius. Depend on g, doesn't depend on all that other stuff. But I had to take energy conservation, and I had to use the fact that I was moving in a circle. So if you see a roller coaster, okay, now it could be that I'm moving at a constant velocity, you know, some velocity. It's very rare that a roller coaster really truly stops you at the top of the hill. And you really genuinely have zero kinetic energy at the top. There are some coasters. There's a coaster right up here, right, in Busch Gardens that does this, that hangs you over the edge and then drops you. But while you're on the top of that edge and you're looking at the loop you're about to go around, do the math real quick and make sure that you're more than 5/2 of that loop radius above the ground, or else you're not going to make it. And if you want to incorporate friction, and there's some extra energy lost to friction before you get to the top of the loop, you could add it in if you knew how to calculate it, and the same technique would work, okay? But you really should be, you know, over twice the height of the loop when you go into that loop. Now, this assumes, this is a very, you know, there are a couple of gross things here. This assumed the loop was perfectly circular. You'll see that the loops really aren't. They're a little bit more teardrop shape. And that's precisely to help you get around the loop a little more cleanly doing this. So there is, you know, this is an approximation, but it's a good approximation. And if you actually build something with a real circle and a real piece of line, it'll actually work. The other thing, but if you, since you're neglecting friction in all of this, it doesn't matter whether the initial drop was like that or the initial drop was like that. It doesn't matter whether the drop was fast or slow. All that mattered was that you started out that original height and end up in the loop and don't lose any extra energy from friction. Not that it would ever appear on a midterm or anything, but you can use the exact same approaches to figure out how fast the car is going at the bottom and how fast the car is going at the side. The potential energy is different, of course. The kinetic energy is different. Okay, down at the bottom, all of that energy that you lost from, you know, that you got from gravity is going into your kinetic energy because you got no gravitational potential energy up here. That's, and at the bottom, you're going that fast and you're starting to go around the curve. So your centripetal acceleration is large and it's pointing down like gravity, right? So there's lots of normal force coming up from the track, and you can figure out the normal force from the track there and there, and then at the top it's zero. So you can do all the math associated with this problem, and then after you've figured out stuff from energy, you can use Newton's laws and your statics to figure out how the forces are actually working on the track. And if you're building your real track, you can write down for your engineer friends, here are the maximum normal forces that this track will encounter at these various places. And that will depend on the car's mass. Right? The bigger car certainly encounters more forces than the smaller car. So far, so good? Okay. Sure. So in two, you add in, it's the same terms, right? Because there's no friction in this problem. There's no springs in this problem. So all you have are potential and kinetic energy. So at the bottom, you have no potential energy. And your kinetic energy is 1/2 mv2 squared. Right? And now you know the height. So you know 1/2 mv2 squared is equal to the original total potential energy, mgh. You can figure it out kind of almost in your head, right? What the car's speed is or at the bottom. Now up here, you're halfway up, so it's mgr is the potential energy. And the kinetic energy is 1/2 mv3 squared. So you're going a little bit faster because you got less energy stored in potential energy of gravity. Okay? And then you can connect them all. The much harder part, the much more interesting part, right? The energy conservation part is almost trivial because it's just two terms. But the more interesting part is figuring out the normal forces from the track to keep you moving in a circle. Because the acceleration, at each one of these points, the centripetal acceleration is v squared over r, pointed in a certain direction. Some of that has to be applied from the track at 2 and 3. And at 3, the normal force is perpendicular to the acceleration from gravity, right? But at 2, the normal force has to fight gravity and give you a boost towards the center to keep you going in that circle. So that's why at the bottom of the loop, you get that extra push. You feel heavier. Not just gravity pulling on you, but it's your counteraction against the normal force of the thing pushing you in that circle to make you go around the loop. Okay? So that's the classic roller coaster problem. And then let's do one last problem that incorporates a lot more accounting. So I've got a mass of a certain mass on an inclined plane. And let's see, so this I'll just sketch out for you because it is a little bit absurd, but maybe it's not that absurd. Right, I've got a mass that I start off in an inclined plane, and everything is frictionless, and then it hits the bottom. And so it gets to the bottom, and it's moving. So this is picture one, this is picture two, where it's at the bottom of the ramp. And then it skids along some, you know, not sandpaper, right? It's some friction, some area where you're losing energy, the friction. And then you keep on moving and you hit a spring and compress a spring. So there's a lot going on in this problem. And in fact, you've got to use all of your different terms, right? You've got to use the potential energy due to gravity is mg delta y. You've got to use the potential energy of a spring, because there's a spring in the problem, is 1/2 k delta x squared. You've got to use the kinetic energy equation, because the thing is moving, 1/2 mv squared. And there's some friction and force in there, so you've got to use, you know, the energy loss to friction, at least, is the kinetic coefficient of friction times the normal force times the distance that I moved across the thing. And so ultimately, I might ask, you know, or the problem might ask, okay, how far is the spring going to compress? Let's say I know the spring's k, just like I know this coefficient of friction. I know this distance is the length, the distance of that frictional area. Everywhere else is frictionless. And I know the height that I start the thing off at. So you can almost run the movie, right? You can almost say, okay, I can build an apparatus and do this experiment and then calculate how far the spring compresses. Again, same exact technique. Write down. Now you've got a bunch of different pictures. 1, 2, 3, and 4. A bunch of different scenarios. And you've got a bunch of different energy terms. Potential energy due to gravity really only applies in part one, right? It's mg times h1. And there's no potential energy due to gravity in any of the rest of these if I set y equals 0 at the bottom. Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv1 squared. 1/2 mv2 squared, 1/2 mv3 squared, and 0 because I compressed the spring and I stopped moving. Potential energy due to the spring. Spring is not compressed anywhere except at the very end. 1/2 k, you know, kind of delta x squared. And let's call that 4 for the fourth guy. And here's the tricky part, right? Which is, when do I have to account for friction? I only have to account for friction after I've gone through the frictional area. But then I've thrown that energy away, right? I've taken it out of the system. So I haven't lost any energy to friction at the beginning. I haven't lost it yet at 2, because I haven't gotten to the frictional area yet, but at 3 I certainly have. So by position 3, I have to add into my accounting the energy lost to friction times the normal force at 3 times this length that I traveled through. And I use, I'm a little bit, you know, retentive, right? I'm a little bit pedantic. I put in the normal force at location 3 because, gosh, that could be on an inclined plane. It could be going around the circle. It could be some normal force that you need to calculate. Here it's obvious, if it's a flat surface, the normal force at 3 is equal to the object's weight. But it could be more complicated. So you may as well write it down properly. And then at 4, well, that was the energy I lost, and I didn't get it back. going into the spring, it's still gone. I still need to include it. In my accounting. That's your physics right there. Aside from any subtle details about figuring out the normal force in case this thing is wacky and on an inclined plane or whatever. But going through all of this, I mean, if I had, there's one other energy term, you know, from an external normal, external force, which is a force times a distance, right? You know, work is that. If I was applying an external force to all of this stuff, I could add in just another line here and account for it at each location. That's all I need to do. And then sum all of these together, equate all of those. I have three equations and three unknowns, maybe? Who knows? I've got several unknowns here, right? All of the velocities I don't know, but I can figure them out by unchaining this stuff, right? One equals two. Okay. So I can figure out at the beginning, my velocity one was zero. Let's say I started from rest. And then I know that my velocity at the bottom, I can figure that out if I knew the height. And then I know V2, and I can set V2 equal to this guy. If I know the energy lost to friction, I can figure out where I was at point 3, what the velocity is, and then I can finally figure out how far the spring compresses. I could leap from 1 to 4 and say, okay, the sum of 1 is equal to the sum of 4 in all of these. That's fine. The only issue is if the energy lost in the middle was dependent on something that happened in the middle, this would get a little bit more complicated. I can go straight from 1 to 4 here because I know how much energy was lost to friction. It's just that coefficient of friction times the normal force times the distance that that force was applied. So, you know, you can start doing rather involved and rather, you know, somewhat absurd problems using energy conservation. Next class we'll go into momentum conservation, and it'll do the same thing, except now we'll actually have to deal with components, because momentum conservation is a vector conservation law. But at least for now, you should have the tools necessary to do the homework. So I'll see you guys on Wednesday, and then we'll have fall break.